Washington, D.C. reported 69 new cases yesterday for a total 12,126 confirmed cases. D.C. reported one new COVID-19-related death, bringing total fatalities to 585. The district said two-thirds of cases in July have been of people under the age of 40, and that since the beginning of the month, the percent of hospitalized cases for those under 40 has nearly doubled. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 77 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 79 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Chris Banger-Trounds. Thanks for listening.
All right. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Women Fight Back with Rachel Hu, and that's coming up right about now. Stay tuned.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment line. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share.
Welcome to Women Fight Back here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm your host, Rachel Hu, and if you can hear my voice, that means that this week, like every week, women are fighting back. We are back here with you on the 31st of July. It's 5 p.m. Friday Eastern Standard Time. So we have some headlines we want to get into before we get into our stories for today. If you have not heard, New Jersey lawmakers are expected to pass a bill that would free more than 3,000 prisoners, around 20% of the state's total incarcerated population. And as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to ravage prisons, those who are within a year of completing their sentences in state prisons would be eligible for release, depending on credit given during their time served. This is the first bill of its kind in the United States, and while excluding sex offenders, those sentenced for other violent crimes would be eligible. In Bolivia, turning our attention to Bolivia, Donald Trump has floated the idea of postponing the elections. And exactly that has already happened in Bolivia. Tens of thousands of Bolivians have protested this week against the postponement of general elections by the de facto president and coup leader, Jeanine Añez. The Bolivian Workers Union and the Unity Pact, an alliance of various indigenous and agricultural workers, are demanding that elections be held on September 6th and not on October 18th. The election was supposed to take place back in May, and this is the third time the election has been postponed. The right-wing Añez government has responded by saying it will do whatever is necessary to maintain law and order. And finally, for our headlines for today, a study for UNICEF and environmental group Pure Health, Pure Earth found that an estimated one out of three children in the entire world have high levels of lead in their bloodstreams. These levels are enough to impair brain development, nervous systems, and vital organs such as hearts and lungs. The report cited a wide range of factors causing these high levels of lead, from inadequate recycling of lead-acid batteries, homes with peeling lead paint, lead-laced electronics waste dumps, and food contamination due to lead-glazed pottery. More than 95% of lead from batteries is recycled in the United States and Europe, but developing economies lack the resources and facilities needed to reuse the heavy metals. The report also stated that the longer the toxin goes undetected and remains untreated, the more dangerous and potentially lethal it becomes. So we're going to get into our first story here today about Portland, Oregon. As you may have seen, there has been ongoing struggle for over 60 days at this point since George Floyd was murdered in Portland. And Oregon Governor Kay Brown announced the withdrawal of federal law enforcement agents from Portland. Federal border control and immigration agents deployed through the Department of Homeland Security were ordered in by the Trump administration against the protests. The agents were often heavily armed and clad in unmarked military garb and were widely criticized for excessive force and indiscriminate detention in unmarked cars. So joining the show to talk about what's been going on in the streets of Portland is Mariah Denman, a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation in Portland, who has been on the ground in the middle of the resistance. Welcome, Mariah.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
No worries. I'm really happy to have you on the show. So definitely, let's get into it. Talk to us a little bit about what's been going on in Portland. I know that it says, you know, we've read everywhere, the mainstream media has said that the federal troops are withdrawing. Can you talk about, is that really happening? And what's the real situation on the ground?
Well, as you can imagine, we were all very skeptical about a withdrawal order. We really didn't believe it. So a lot of people turned out last night to see what would happen and to continue to resist federal repression if they were going to continue to be there. But it looks like last night they were not there. They did not come out of the building. We presume that they are probably still in the building. They haven't, I don't think that they've like left the city. I don't see if they have any reason to. But Oregon State Police, it was agreed that between Kate Brown, the mayor, and DHS, that Oregon State Police would come to the city of Portland, establish a 9-block radius around the courthouse, the federal courthouse, and establish an exclusion zone to keep people out, which obviously that's been we're resisting against that. And so now it's like the purview of OSP to maintain that exclusion zone and to maintain, you know, peace and law and order, whatever, in that zone. And basically what I can see happening is that if something escalates or if, like, you know, the DHS decides that OSP is not handling it the way they want, then the feds will just come back out. Like, there's no reason for them to stay away forever.
For sure. I think that that's a really astute observation, and I definitely agree. Can you speak a little bit more to how the local government has been handling this? I know a lot of the framing that I've been seeing in the mainstream media has really been that it's the local government of the Democrats leading the charge alongside of people in the streets against the evil federal government. Can you help us complicate that narrative a bit, especially with, you know, Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, and even those recent statements I mentioned from the governor of Oregon? Would love to hear a little bit more about your perspective, and as somebody who's been living in Portland and been there for quite some time.
Yeah, I can absolutely complicate that narrative for you, because our affectionate nickname for our mayor, Ted Wheeler, is Tear Gas Teddy, because he has, since the beginning of these protests 64 days ago, he has refused to use his power as the police commissioner. The mayor here serves as the police commissioner to limit police use of force, specifically use of CS gas. We have been, before the feds arrived on July 4th, people of Portland were being tear gassed every night and pepper sprayed and, you know, subject to impact munitions, et cetera, by Portland police. That was basically a month and a few days. And he has been using, Ted Wheeler has been using the exact same rhetoric, in maybe a little bit more softer terms against protesters, calling us violent, you know, that we have, there are violent anarchists in the crowd and, that we need to be dealt with, and that basically we deserve to be brutalized by our own police force, which is the same, rhetoric that's been deployed by DHS and by, the president himself.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's interesting that even Ted Wheeler is saying this whole kind of cry against anarchists. I know Mike Pompeo said that recently, that the protesters are actually anarchists, and just kind of this big push that, you know, anarchism is something to be criminalized. And, you know, it doesn't matter if that's actually your belief. It's just kind of amazing to see, really, that this kind of criminalization of the protesters themselves, despite the fact that not only has the protesters been overwhelmingly peaceful, that violence has ultimately come come from the state first and foremost, really on the ground, especially in Portland. I think that can be made very clear. So I think it's an interesting way that we see this criminalization emerging. I mean, it's literally it's right out of the playbook of Richard Nixon. This is what was done in the 60s. It's what was done, back during the criminalization of the Black Panther Party, as well as other radical organizations that really were fighting for this kind of fundamental change that we're seeing people fight for today. So I would love to know some of your thoughts on this kind of idea, you know, of this criminalization of the protesters and the protests, but also just kind of the overarching history in Portland. Why do you feel that Donald Trump, of all places, wanted to target Portland? I mean, there's been ongoing protests, essentially, across the country, some that have never stopped, just like in Portland, but yet Portland was really his top choice. So what are your thoughts about this kind of criminalization and the choice of Portland as a town for the federal government to really focus on?
Yeah, great question. So first I'll say that the city of Portland has a long history of mass mobilization and protests, particularly in the 60s and 70s against the Vietnam War, against the repression of the Black Panther Party. There were huge student strikes at our local city university, Portland State University, in 1971. And so I just want to shout out our predecessors in struggle. To the second point about why Portland would be targeted specifically, I think there are three main things. The first is that we have a liberal mayor and a liberal governor, and also a female governor, which we've seen the way that Donald Trump treated the governor of Michigan. He does not like women in power. Those are two main things. The second thing is that shortly after Trump was elected and when he started rolling out these immigration laws to curb, quote unquote, illegal immigration and repealing DACA, et cetera, the city of Portland voted to become a sanctuary city, which, ultimately doesn't really mean a whole lot. It just means that the city, the PPD, won't actually help ICE carry out raids, but it won't stop them from doing it either. So that's another thing. Trump has always targeted sanctuary cities and threatened to, withdraw federal funding from those cities. So that's another reason that we're targeted. And then the slightly more complicated reason is just that there has long been a presence of quote unquote Antifa organization in the city. And in some ways, it's sort of more of an aesthetic that just is sort of popular here. But there are organizations that use the black and red flags and the Iron Front three arrows symbol and identify themselves as anti-fascist. And they come out against, these sort of reactionary groups that tend to, rear their heads every couple of months. Mm. But specifically after the 2016 election, we had enormous protests that were largely, there was the masses of people, but the Antifa, quote unquote, with the flags and stuff, were really visible presence. And after the inauguration, Donald Trump's inauguration in 2017 as well. I could say more, but.
No, for sure. I mean, I think I was just wanting you to continue. I mean, I'm learning so much, and I think you're very right. Donald Trump has really been using Portland as kind of this, he's just been really focusing on it as a place to target, to signal to his base, ultimately, all that he represents. And I think it's also interesting because Oregon overwhelmingly is quite a red state, except for Portland. I mean, overwhelmingly outside of mm-hmm. Portland, almost every place you go to in Oregon is very right wing. I have family actually that lives out there. So it's really interesting to me to kind of see that and see the way that plays itself out in this dynamic. But either way, we have about 2 minutes left. Mariah, is there anything else you really want us to know about the resistance? What does our audience here in New York City need to take away about kind of the courageous everyday heroes that have stepped up in Portland?
I think the main thing is that the fight back continues. The struggle continues. We're not going to be silenced just because we had a quiet night last night with very little, police activity, no police riot last night. We're not going home. We're not giving up. And it's nice to have a break from being tear gassed by feds and by the PPD, but we're ready for anything. And, we want to assert our right to protest. But ultimately, the whole city right now is trying to reframe the narrative that's coming out of the city. Yes, we want to assert our right to protest. We want to assert our like sovereignty as a city and as a state against federal oppression of our right to protest. But ultimately, these are protests in defense of Black lives, and we want the war on Black America to stop. And that's what we come out night after night in support of.
Absolutely. Well, Mariah, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective. That was the voice of Mariah Denman, a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation in Portland, Oregon. She's been on the ground resisting. If you want to follow her work more, you can follow her at PSL Web to get more updates on what's going on, as well as PSLWeb.org. She also wrote a recent piece for Liberation News. That's liberationnews.org about the recent struggle in Portland and the history behind it. So either way, again, thank you, Mariah, for joining the show. We're going to keep the women's movement moving on. We're going to turn our attention now to a different story here locally in New York City about the family of Imani Fekou, who died in a StarVet facility this past June. Imani was 24 years old, and her case brings to light the struggle of Black women in the mental health system and with mental health broadly. Her family says that she died this past June because of neglect that she faced in the facility. Joining the show today is Jennifer Fekou. She has been fighting for justice for her daughter, as well as Kirby Joseph, a community organizer working with Imani's family, a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Welcome, Kirby and Jennifer.
Hi.
Hello, hello. Well, either way, Jennifer is on her way. We're still working on getting her on the show. So, Kirby, can you talk to us a little bit about what this case is and why it's so important for us to pay attention to right now, especially in this conversation of Black women in mental health and how these two things overlap?
Well, it's interesting because we actually met Jennifer at a Sandra Bland action in Union Square on July 13th. It was the annual Sandra Bland action. And that's where we met Jennifer, and she started talking to our comrade Kay about Imani and giving details. And this is a situation that happened just this past June, just a few weeks ago. And she was struggling to get any information about what happened to her daughter and to have anyone hear about her story. And what happened to Imani? Imani is a 24-year-old girl. Actually, August 9th would have been her 25th birthday. And she was at the StarBend facility where she was getting treatment. And she had a psychologist. She had a group that was supposed to help her with her mental care. And she got into an argument, and Jennifer will say more, and got into an argument with another patient and was not listened to, was not given a chance to say her piece, and what happened was immediately kicked out of the facility. And on top of this, she was reeling off of giving a prescription that caused her, before this she did not have it, but caused her to have extreme suicide ideation, to have extreme weight gain, and be in a place that she wasn't in. And Jennifer, you can definitely please jump in and add on. And one of the things that Jennifer has told us is that when she was removed from that facility and went back home to her grandmother's home is where she passed away. And I want to just, if it's okay, Rachel, pass it to Jennifer to give more details about the case.
Uh-huh. For sure. Welcome. I'm glad we could have you on, Jennifer. We're just talking about the, what happened with your daughter. So please share for our audience more about the situation and what you want people here in New York City to know.
So Imani Niaasia Fekou is my daughter. She was a very amazing young lady that always loved to see the best in everyone. And she listened and respected others. And she respected everyone. So what happened to my daughter was that her team, she had an expensive private medical team, and they stopped listening to her. So even though she complains of all the side effects from the meds, in the end, when she complains of, well, when she gave them a detailed plan for suicide, it was evident that they were not listening to her, because instead of getting her immediate protection from herself, because the medication or whatever was not stable, or she was unstable on the medication, it was their job to protect her. They pretty much assisted in her suicide by relaying the message to the benefactor. However, my mother, who was her immediate caretaker, was not informed. And when my mom left her for 2 hours, she came back, and it was too late at that point.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing, Jennifer. I know it can't be easy. You know, one of the things I think that really, to me, you know, speaks about what happened with your daughter is just that, you know, how important it is to talk about and really bring to light, you know, the way, you know, especially that Black women are treated in the healthcare system. You know, I think a lot about childbirth and the astronomical rates of deaths that happen to Black women in healthcare. And you have to imagine, you know, that this kind of systematic racism that pervades everything, whether it's the police institutions in this country, whether it's the education system, or whether it's the healthcare system, that there's so much overlap. And that to me really speaks volumes about, you know, kind of what's happened to Imani speaks volumes. So, yeah, go for it.
Right. So it wasn't one thing that happened to Imani. So like you said, the system failed her. The systemic racism she experienced just living in the dorm, being kicked out of the dorm because of a verbal disagreement between her and another client. But Imani wasn't valued enough to be kept in safe housing, so they kicked her out. The pharmaceutical company, after she passed, I did my own research, and I found that there was one study in 2012, and 19 people died on the meds, those meds after only one year use. And the majority of them died from an overdose and suicide completed. And the doctors and her medical staff had become complicit, and they no longer really cared for her. We're going to have a vigil for Imani on what would be her 25th birthday, August 9th, at Parkside by Prospect Park. And you can show support and raise awareness. Yes, and we also have a GoFundMe for... to build a safe house, to create a real safe house for children who are alive, because we want to keep them that way.
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful mission to really keep pushing for. I mean, I know a lot of folks right now in the streets demanding justice for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, you know, are saying defund the police and fund our communities. And what you're talking about is the type of programming that we need in our communities. It's the type of programming that could have saved, you know, the life of Imani, or really save all the other lives out there that are not paid attention to. And I think what you're saying about the medication is a very important point, especially when we talk, you know, even broadly about the inequality inequality in medicine. The inequality for women in medicine is very serious because biologically women are different. And because of that, a lot of times medications are not tailored. The majority of test subjects, they're all tailored towards men and men's bodies. And so women oftentimes, I mean, you look at epilepsy medication as an example. There's a couple of different medications as well that have had a history of really frankly being generally less effective for women. I mean, even autism, you know, diagnoses of autism are very inadequate for women. ADHD. There's so many situations where we see that women slip through the healthcare system just by virtue of being women. And that's that history of discrimination and just lack of access for women in healthcare. So I think that's a wonderful point. We have one more minute. I want to give it, you know, Kirby, can you wrap us up, you know, on this segment about everything and let us know more about that vigil?
Yeah, I just want to make it extremely, extremely clear that Imani isn't with us because she wasn't listened to. And it's something that happens every day that's happening right now within the system, whether it be people being heard for their safety or whether they're being heard at a facility that's supposed to care for them or a mental health facility. We know that the system does not work for marginalized people, especially women, especially Black women. There's an infamous quote by Malcolm X, the most oppressed person in America is the Black woman. And that's something that we still see. The medical system was based off of torturing women, torturing Black women. And we know if that is the history, then they obviously can't care for our women, for us, and definitely not for Imani, who we lost in June. So on August 9th, on Parkside and Ocean Avenue in Prospect Park, we're going to have a vigil for Imani and uplift her on what would have been her 25th birthday. And we're asking for community to come out. The family has done their own individual, intimate vigils and ceremony for Imani, but Jennifer and the family are calling for community to come in and support because Imani represents how broken the system is and how much it needs to change. We need something new. And that's what Jennifer is fighting for. And what Jennifer was talking about, ImaniSafeHouse.com, please go on it, donate to it. It's sad that struggle is what is bringing these dreams alive, but this is what the family is doing. They're fighting for Imani, but now the mission is bigger. We're fighting for all Imani.
That's right. Thank you so much, Kirby. I know we will have to end it here. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for being on the show. That was the voice of Jennifer Faku. She is the mother of Imani Faku. Yes, absolutely. And she came on to share her story. I want you to learn more about it. Like Kirby said, definitely please go to that website. That was also the voice of Kirby Joseph, a community organizer working with the family and member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can follow Kirby's work more at PSL Web. Like she said, definitely go and support Imani's family. Learn more about this. The fight for mental health, really mental health care for Black women and for women in general, is something that is so necessary. And especially when we're talking right now about systematic racism, we cannot neglect or look the other direction in cases like Imani's. So either way, we're going to have to keep the women's movement moving on. You're listening to Women Fight Back here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm your host, Rachel Hu. And if you can hear my voice, that means that this week, like every week, women are fighting back. So before we get into our next stories, which I'm excited to bring you, I do want to take a minute and just talk to you a little bit about what you just heard. What we just talked about was the on-the-ground reporting from Portland. You're hearing on-the-ground reports of what's happening, and you just heard from a mother who lost her daughter to the systematic racism that continues to really just destroy communities of color. And so what I want to continue to say is that you're not going to hear that anywhere else. You're going to hear that here on WBAI, because WBAI is independent news. It is 100% funded by you, our listeners. This, it makes a difference. Today, like I said, we've been joined by women activists and organizers from across the country. So I want to ask you to become a WBAI buddy. And what you can do is become a BAI buddy in the name of Women Fight Back. Women Fight Back as a show. We are about bringing the voices of the grassroots to you, to our audience, to our listener, to actually talk about what's going on in the streets and really speak honestly and boldly about the movement that is alive and well. The mainstream media is acting like the movement has moved on, that there is not a resistance in the streets. But I'm going to tell you, and these organizers on this show are going to tell you that that isn't true. You can call 516-620-3602. or give to WBAI.org and say you want to become a WBAI buddy in the name of Women Fight Back. You can say that, you know what? You can say, you know, WBAI, I love this station. I'm not sure if I can become, you know, if I can give that much money to the station, but that's okay. Every dollar makes a difference. For just $10 a month, you could subscribe, go online, and become a WBAI buddy in the name of Women Fight Back to support this kind of programming, the real programming that actually gives you the stories from the streets. If you subscribe for $35 for a full year, you're going to get a WBAI face mask, and it's going to say, keep free speech radio alive. And that's exactly what we're fighting to do. You can call 516-620-3602. Or go to give to WBAI.org. 516-620-3602. Give to WBAI.org. Become a buddy in the name of Women Fight Back. $10 a month, even $5 a month, whatever you can give. Instead of getting a coffee, you know, say that I want to support independent media, independent journalism to tell the real stories of the community. Like came on the show earlier, Jennifer lost her daughter. That's a real story from the community that we want to continue to uplift here on WBAI. And we can't if we are not on the airwaves. So continue to support us. Again, call 516-620-3602. So we are going to go to a break here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And when we get back, we're going to talk more about the teacher strikes and the ongoing struggle across the country to stop the reopening of the schools. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. You're listening to Women Fight Back, and I'm your host, Rachel Hu. If you can hear my voice, that means that this week, like every week, women are fighting back. So we're going to get right into our next story. But before we do that, I want to give you one final reminder. Call 516-620-3602. Become a WBI buddy in the name of Women Fight Back. Support this wonderful work. We're about to hear an amazing story about a nationwide teacher strike. So definitely continue to support stories like these. So, like I said, we are talking today about the teacher strike happening. One of the nation's largest teachers union is authorizing its members to strike if the schools plan to reopen without proper safety measures in the middle of a global pandemic. The American Federation of Teachers, which represents 1.7 million school employees, issued a resolution on Tuesday saying that it will support any local chapter that does decide to strike over reopening plans. And many are talking about and moving in action in accordance with this. So joining the show to discuss the upcoming possible strikes, as well as the current state of teachers organizing, is Amrita Denis. She's an ESL teacher in Boston Public Schools and a member of the Boston Teachers Union and an executive board member of the AFT in Massachusetts. Welcome, Amrita.
Hi, good to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So either way, get right into it. Can you talk a little bit more about what is going on here? You know, what does this mean when the Federation of Teachers says, you know, what does this resolution mean for teachers and for families across the country?
Sure. So, yeah, as you said in your introduction, I'm a teacher in Boston public schools. And in Boston, you know, in Massachusetts in general, actually, the public sector is not legally permitted to strike. But this resolution from AFT National that authorizes safety strikes and provides backing for safety strikes, essentially, is an important step in us building the power in our communities to take decisive action if our, you know, our local superintendents, our mayors, our city and state level decision makers aren't willing to listen to reason, right? Aren't willing to put the lives of people ahead of reopening the economy. So I think that above all of this, I think pushes the conversation forward. That we need to do this. We need to fight for our lives. We cannot go back into schools that are unsafe, into buildings that are unsafe. In Boston, 70% of the buildings don't have working HVAC systems. Like, they don't have good quality air in the school. So you can't be sending people back into classrooms that are not safe in the middle of a global pandemic. When Massachusetts, though it, you know, has gotten its infection rates down, is now seeing an uptick right now, right? So we can't be hasty to go back in person and risk people's lives. And pretty much all that I'm hearing is from people who are interested in, you know, making sure parents have childcare so that they can go back to work. And that should not be the reason that we put people's lives in danger.
For sure. I mean, I think this rush to reopening kind of broadly, I mean, I feel like, you know, the struggle for reopening is really kind of solidifying here in the fight for schools, because, you know, for a lot of, you know, families, schools just represent normalcy, right? They represent being able, like you said, to have childcare and just moving back into the world. And I think it's very interesting to me, you know, like the Betsy DeVos's of the world are like not likely going to send their kids back to school. I mean, that's not really what's going on. It's an ask to really to force the working class and everyday people, you know, back into life without doing anything whatsoever to curb this pandemic. I mean, the purpose of a shutdown is to buy more time for the government to be able to put into place everything that was necessary. So across the country, I mean, the explosions in Texas, the explosions in other parts of like Florida, for example, should speak to the fact that we are nowhere near ready to reopen on any level or any scale. And yet this kind of false narrative is being talked about, that it's about, you know, whether or not you're, you know, reopening and the interest of parents or the interest of teachers. And it's just not true. So I guess, could you speak to that a little bit? You know, this false narrative that's been painted. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because one of the you know, facts that we've learned as we've been working as a union to work with the school, the Boston Public Schools, with the leadership there to try to plan for the reopening, is, first of all, that, you know, they did a survey of families in Boston. They sent out a survey to families, and then they were, you know, they kind of paraded the statistic around that, oh, it looks like a lot of families actually would prefer in-person schooling. So their plan that the district released included in-person schooling. It was a hybrid model that involves, they have like a cutesy name for it. It's the hopscotch model, which basically means that students come in either Monday and Tuesday or Thursday and Friday of the week. They do Wednesday remote. They are expected to watch live streams of their classes on the days that they're not in school and keep up in that way. So it's a plan that, you know, if you're a teacher, you know, if you are a student, when you look at that a little closer, you're like, wait, that's kind of a silly plan. That doesn't seem to really show an understanding of what happens in a classroom. But the crazier thing is that statistic they cited from that survey, first of all, the survey question didn't include the caveat that the buildings would be safe, right? So they asked parents, would you send your child back to school if it's safe to do so? But they haven't put in place any sort of broad plan for how they're actually going to ensure safety and meet the safety and health standards that experts agree are necessary to reopen schools, right? So they're not necessarily prioritizing improving buildings. They're not prioritizing. They're not committing to regular testing. They're not committing nor do they have a clear plan around contact tracing and what happens if someone does get sick. They don't have a plan for PPE for students and staff, and especially for staff working with students with severe disabilities, students with autism. So there's that. And then the other thing that I think speaks to a little bit of what you're saying as well is that they didn't disaggregate that statistic by race. But if you did, you'd see that it's mostly white families that have a preference for in-person schooling. And many of those families actually want a full reopening, not even hybrid. And it's Black and Latinx families that are far more cautious. They're, you know, the statistics are completely skewed if you break it down by race. And Black and Latinx families overwhelmingly would prefer a remote reopening or a hybrid model. But again, that's like that wasn't made super clear as to what that would look like. But there's like a clear divide there between people, people who are first a racial divide and then an economic divide. And yeah, that's just something that's not really being talked about. If you look at Massachusetts as a whole, you'll also see, there are certain areas that are still hotspots, certain areas that are in itself. East Boston, which is a working class neighborhood with many Central American families, has become a COVID hotspot and stayed that way. Right. I have students who live in East Boston and have seen family members get sick, have, struggled to engage with remote learning because they were dealing with taking care of family members or got COVID themselves. Right. So none of these plans are considering, first of all, that we are still in a pandemic. Second of all, that this pandemic is disproportionately impacting working class people of color.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think there's so much to go off of there and just really parse out. I mean, just the concept of sending kids back to school is ridiculous, frankly. Like, any school building anywhere, but especially here in New York City. I mean, come on. Like, have you not met children? Like, children are going to like touch each other. They're going to lick each other. It's just what they do. Like, it's just, I can't even imagine it. Like, I used to teach. And so I always talk about this, that it's like, this idea that we're going to martyr teachers. It's like teachers are so self-sacrificing. No, teachers are having their rights and their power being taken away from them by, really ultimately the demands of the state government. So I don't know, no teacher is saying, yes, I want to die for education. It's not an acceptable thing. And that's why it's really beautiful to me to see this fight back, to say that no, it's not only just for that teachers deserve the right to be safe, but so do families and so do children. I mean, we act like children can't get COVID-19, and that is absolutely not true. Yes, the numbers are lower, of course, but to say, a lot of that has to do with the fact that kids are staying home, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that we don't fully understand this disease. And just because statistically it's lower doesn't mean it's impossible, right? So we are going to lose some children, just like we're going to lose some teachers if we force hundreds of people back into a building. I mean, it's inevitable in the middle of a pandemic. That is just what it is. So I think we have 2 more minutes left for this segment. Could you share with us a little bit about what the organizing is that's happening on the ground? Because I see that while there is this big push, the state and the federal government to say, you guys need to go back into the schools. There's also a massive resistance, both with the community and with teachers. So can you speak a little bit about to what that looks like, not just in Boston, but across the country for all of our listeners to get a sense of the resistance we are sure to see in the coming month?
Yeah, for sure. So I think, I think there's a lot happening in every single city in this country. I think I think teachers unions in general are united on this front. In Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Teachers Association, which is part of the National Education Association, also released, guidance around demanding that we go back remotely for the safety of our students, families, and teachers. On August 3rd, on Monday, there's going to be a National Day of Action, a National Day of Resistance around safety in schools, equity, equitable funding of schools, which is something we didn't even really touch on that totally affects schools' ability to be ready for this, to be ready to reopen. So on August 3rd, there are actions in many cities across the country. In Boston, there will be a budget forum around safe around equitable funding of schools and how that connects to this current crisis. And then going forward through August, I think you can expect to see a lot of actions, a lot of really creative actions that that showcase the danger of going back to school while also keeping people safe. Yeah, I think you're going to see a strike wave if districts do not put the lives of people before their, you know, plans for economic reopening.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rita. I know there's also a demonstration probably here on Monday as well in New York City. And like you said, I think it couldn't be put any other way that we're going to see a wave of strikes as teachers continue to lead the movement to really fight not just for education, but for working class people as a whole. So that was the voice of Amrita Denise. She is an ESL teacher in Boston Public Schools, as well as a member of the Boston Teachers Union and an executive board member of the AFT in Massachusetts. Thank you so much for being on the air, and we are going to keep the women's movement moving on. You are listening to Women Fight Back here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm your host, Rachel Hu, and if you can hear my voice, that means that this week, like every week, women are fighting back. So we're going to get into our last story of the day, talking about evictions. And not just evictions happening, but the incredible resistance building against evictions. Protesters in New Orleans stood side by side in a blockade to prevent evictions. Banging pots and pans and locking arms together, dozens of protesters stopped people from entering City Hall and the civil district courts. The protests succeeded in disrupting a variety of court hearings, including evictions. Protesters stated that this action was necessary because of government inaction in the face of a wave of evictions that could soon wash over the entire city. A moratorium on evictions in federally backed properties ended last Saturday, and as of Thursday afternoon, in New Orleans, there has been 343 evictions filed since the ending of the state moratorium on June 15th. Now, the reality is that evictions across the country, we are going to see a spike this month as these federal moratoriums begin to end, as well as state moratoriums end. So we're going to get right into it, talking about what this means for tenants. Joining the show is Tisha, a Baltimore renter and housing organizer who advocates for affordable, accessible, healthy, and safe housing. Welcome, Tisha.
Thank you for having me.
For sure. So I know we're talking about New Orleans. I know you're from Baltimore, but to me, it's a national story. You know, whether we're talking about, you know, what's going on there or going on here in New York City, I think no matter what we're speaking about, the truth is a wave of evictions is about to hit everybody across the country. There are 50 million people unemployed from coronavirus. So many people, as their checks run up at the end of the month, are also going to have no way to continue to pay the rent. So can you share a little bit more about what you think about this action of people banding together to fight against evictions? And what is the current state of evictions in Baltimore? And what do you think about the evictions happening in a pandemic?
Yeah, it really underscores the priorities that this country, this society, this especially this government has with regards to those who are worthy and those who are expendable. You know, we're about to lose the extra federal funds that people are receiving for their unemployment. So anyone who is receiving the $600 to subsidize their unemployment, that's ending mm-hmm. as of today. And at the same time, you know, people's housing is at jeopardy. So the two don't go together. You throw number three in the mix that across the nation, there are spikes in the positivity of positivity testing of COVID-19. So we're really seeing how much this country really values the lives of its citizens. I'm sorry, its consumers, because we really need to understand how we are qualified. This country has a history of naming us. And when I say us, I'm talking about, you know, Caucasian, but also, you know, brown, black, Latinx. We went from being, well, not we, but people were initially qualified as countrymen, patriots. then citizens, then voters, and now we are consumers. When you listen, when you read, for the most part, we are now consumers. So think about that. If you don't have the wherewithal, the resources to optimally consume, you are expendable. Your life is worthless to this country. So deeming these individuals, myself included, deeming these individuals worthy of healthy, safe, and permanently affordable housing is a foreign concept if you are not of a certain ilk, if you don't have a certain power, if you are economically challenged. So, unfortunately, brown and black people, and especially brown and black women, are the ones who fall in this category. But, you know, this COVID-19 doesn't care what your ethnic background, your gender, doesn't matter. So we're seeing that the dregs are being pulled back on what we already knew what was happening. In Baltimore,
no, for sure.
In Baltimore has, you know, pre-COVID had one of the highest rates of evictions. Our evictions go, I think you can, in 1 hour per day, we get 4 evictions.
Wow.
And that's because the laws in Baltimore really are geared toward the landlords. We're nationwide, and I know New York is really ramping up their efforts. But nationwide, there's an initiative to provide a right to counsel for renters. And just imagine if this were a criminal case and you didn't have the right or you didn't have the financial means to counsel, to, you know, legal counsel. In this country, if that is the case, if you are being criminally charged with something, you have the right to a public defender.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go to court for an eviction, you don't have that right.
Mm-hmm.
And 94% of the time when someone enters an eviction, enters the eviction court without representation, they are found, the case is found against them.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
94% of the time.
It's crazy. And I think what you're saying is so important, right? Is that, you know, in the middle of a global pandemic, we have evictions sweeping the country. I mean, you know, people are out of work for absolutely no fault of their own. So this kind of narrative that we always hear that, you know, you're not looking for work, you're not trying hard enough, it's just not
exactly
true. I mean, people literally cannot have access to any workplace that many people were let go of because it closed down entirely from a pandemic. And so, you know, to me, the call for canceling the rents and canceling, you know, the mortgages. I mean, there are countries across the world that canceled mortgages, just canceled them.
Exactly.
The federal government paid for the rents, paid the landlords for the rents, so that way families in the middle of a pandemic, through no fault of their own, could continue to survive and live. And like you said, people, you know, people being cut off from unemployment right now means that we're just going to have, you know, across the board, millions of people impacted, if not millions of families that could be facing eviction. And I think it's unique what you're saying about Baltimore, because in New York City, we do have housing court and some people do qualify for a free housing lawyer. It's something that was passed recently here in New York City to make that happen. So if you are anyone listening, if you do need access, look into it. You can get access to a housing, you know, a housing lawyer. But I think what you're saying is so true that, you know, state by state, it's so different and there is no standardization of what people have in terms of rights. But, you know, in the middle of a pandemic and generally people have the right to housing. I mean, how can you survive?
Exactly.
How can you function? How can you live? How can you do literally anything? How can you work if you don't have housing? I mean, we see people
housing
that are in.
Housing should be seen as a human right, a basic
it
human
is.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, there's no question about it. I mean, studies have been done over decades indicating how many health conditions, can be preempted if healthy and safe housing is the first prescription provided. You know, even with drug addiction, you know, there, even in, I think it was in New York, there was a program that started, I think it was maybe like 15 years ago, where, you know, these advocates said, you know, we need to stop saying that these homeless individuals, these people who are on the streets, before you're eligible for housing, you have to get clean. No, you get them housed first. And then they becoming on these substance abuse programs is much easier. Get people housed first, and then you can help them control their diabetes and avoid amputations. You know, get people housed. Get them in stable housing, and all kinds of health conditions can be prevented.
Absolutely.
Know,
so, Tisha,
this country doesn't. Yeah.
I do got to stop you there, even though you're so right. I know we do have to close out, but I think, you know, one of the things that I want to say is that it's amazing that you're fighting back. If you want to do a quick 20 seconds, why is it so important for us to organize, and why is what's happening in New Orleans so important for us to do across the country?
What we need to realize is that our bodies, our feet, our voices are power. They are power. And when we come together united, then we send the message that we are not going anywhere. We're not going anywhere. This country, why did they give us the money to begin with? Because they know that people are going to put the money back into the economy. If we understand our power and the power of coming together beyond our differences, beyond our various ethnicities, beyond our sexual orientations, when we know that, then the rest of the peons are the ones who are ranking the power. But we need to send a message to them that we are in control.
Yes, thank you so much, Tisha. That was the voice of Tisha, Baltimore renter and housing organizer who advocates for affordable, accessible health and safe housing. So either way, you've been with me, your host, Rachel Hu, for the past hour listening to Women Fight Back here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Remember, all issues are women's issues. Just like Tisha said about women in housing, couldn't be truer. You can follow us on social media at WBAI Women. And we also have a podcast you can follow as well. We are out of time for today. Until next time, you can join us Friday night at 5 p.m. Tune in. We want to see you there. And definitely, like I said, continue to support WBAI and the work we're doing here on Women Fight Back.
When the one who's burned turns to pass the torch. Evil is a relay sport. When the one who's burned turns to pass the torch. Evil is a relay sport. When the one who's burned turns to pass the torch. Evil is a relay sport. When the one who's burned turns to pass the torch. Evil is a relay sport. When the one who's burned turns to pass the torch. Evil is a relay sport. When the one who's burned turns to pass the torch. I resent you for being raised right. I resent you for being tall. I resent you for never getting any opposition at all. I resent you for having each other.
Hello, WBAI listeners and supporters.
Tune in Friday, July 31st from 10 p.m. to midnight
for the second report of 2020 from the WBAI Local Station Board.
This month, you'll hear from various members of the board.
They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network,
and ask for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI.
So mark that date on your calendar.
Friday, July 31st, 10 p.m. to midnight.
The second report of 2020 from the WBAI Local Station Board.
Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial.
Streaming live at WBAI.org.
This week on Working Class Heroes Radio. Lian Carlos will be speaking with Madel Hidalgo and Clever Cruz, both Dominican activists, about confronting anti-blackness and anti-queerness in the NYC Dominican community. So tune in this Saturday at 6 p.m. for our new episode, Confronting Racism in Inwood, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City's main source of community radio.
I wear a mask for my fellow New Yorkers.
My mama, who's a healthcare worker.
Nurses and doctors.
For my father.
For the marginalized communities who don't have access to adequate healthcare.
For my children.
My community.
Essential workers.
Transit workers.
The immunocompromised.
I wear a mask so we can get back to work.
Go to school. Share a meal.
See a movie.
Hug my friends.
Dance together.
Go to the theater.
See our families.
Continue to show support.
Take care of each other.
Save lives.
Stay strong.
Once every 10 years, America mounts a census and attempts to count every single person living in the country, citizens and non-citizens, immigrants, documented and undocumented alike. This is an extremely difficult goal, even under ideal circumstances, and even as the actions of the current U.S. government has created fear and uncertainty that all but ensures that many immigrants will stay in the shadows, too terrified to risk contact with any governmental official, census takers included. However, by law, namely Title 13 of the U.S. Code, the Census Bureau cannot release any information about you, your business, or your immigration status to law enforcement. So step out of the shadows, stand up and be counted. This is a public service of WBAI Community Outreach.